right, welcome. We're going to do a show today about, I mean, in general, the role of women in STEM, although we'll be maybe branching out from STEM from time to time, and especially the whole issue of credit, patents, recognition, journal articles. At the end of the show, you're going to hear a conversation about Wikipedia, which, you know, theoretically is the most democratic, small d democratic way of just chronicling everything, basically. But even Wikipedia has its shortcomings, and so women have had to make a very special effort to make sure that important stories are told and told in the right way. But our main guide through this process is Anissa Ramirez, scientist and science communicator. She gave a TED Talk on the importance of STEM education, was a mechanical engineering professor at Yale for 10 years, currently writing a book called The Alchemy of Us. Welcome back to WNPR. You've been here many times. Not maybe physically here, but you've been with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
So, you know, let's begin with the most bad and annoying example and get it out of the way. America has been sort of transfixed over the last 6 months or so with an example that in a story that in no way resembles the main thrust of the way women have been treated in STEM and as inventors and as patent seekers. And that is the story of Elizabeth Holmes, although I sort of see the story of Elizabeth Holmes as a story of a whole bunch of very powerful men who were completely fooled and very easily fooled, I think. But here's Elizabeth Holmes. Her journey resembles essentially nobody else's.
Do not let anybody tell you that you can't do it. I mean, I've been told that so many times. First time that I started going into meetings, you know, with the enterprises that we were working with, you know, people would say, "Oh, you know, you're the assistant," and I was like, "No, I'm the engineer." But believe in yourself. I mean, we've got to, especially with young women, create a stereotype that women can be the best in science, in technology, in engineering, and women can found technology companies and be CEOs of multi-billion dollar technology companies.
I mean, there are things in that quote that are very real things. And I mean, Rosalind Franklin, who had played a huge role in the work that Watson and Crick wind up getting credit for, one of the reasons initially that she was misunderstood, there was another scientist named Wilkins who didn't realize she was leading a team. He thought she was the assistant. She was doing something, you know, for somebody else. So that's real. The problem is it must make you just want to just bang your head a little bit. Holmes becoming so famous as an example of essentially ultimately a fraudulent scientist when so many other legit women scientists just don't get any recognition.
Well, she definitely rode that curve of women in STEM. I do think that we need to look at this story again if it was written by a woman about, as you just mentioned, it was a lot of rich old guys who got fooled as well. But she was definitely taking advantage of this thrust that's going on with focusing on women in STEM and wanting to encourage them to be successful. And in the process, people didn't do their due diligence. And so it was a big fraud.
She took advantage of another thing that I know bothers you, too, which, I mean, her two big heroes are Thomas Edison and Steve Jobs. So this is sort of the great man theory of science, or maybe the great person theory of science, that we need one person every single time. Or I guess in the case of Watson and Crick, we'd be willing to expand all the way up to two. But, you know, we look for the story of one person to tell the story of an innovation that probably did take a lot of other people.
Well, that's the whole thing about science. We like to glorify the inventor, but there's a lot of people who are actually doing the work. Edison had people he called the muckers who are actually doing all the things that were behind all of his inventions. He has over 1,000 inventions because people were working things out based on his ideas, and so that's how he was able to get all those inventions. Jobs was, he was a marketer, but he had a lot of people working for him. But what Holmes was doing, she was idolizing both of them, but she wasn't doing the thing that they did do, which is the work, and to prove something that was make something actually worked.
So let's talk about some of the people that you have discovered, people who are unsung. Maybe start with a New Haven story, Sarah Boone.
Well, I was working on my book, The Alchemy of Us, and as I was looking through some old papers in New Haven in the library, I saw this slip of paper that said Sarah Boone had invented an early ironing board. And I had heard her name before, but I did not know she was from New Haven. So I did a little digging and found out that in 1892, Sarah Boone, African-American woman, got an early ironing board. She got a patent for that. She did that at the age of 60. What's so phenomenal about her is that at 48, she couldn't read. Mm-hmm. By the age of 60, she could. And so that's huge.
Yeah.
And to go from, you know, not being able to read to creating a technical document. She came to New Haven from North Carolina before the Civil War, so there were a lot of struggles. This is an African-American woman living in New Haven in the 1800s. And to have, at the very end of her life, a patent, I just thought that was significant. And I think we need to learn more about her story, because if she can do those kinds of things in that situation, then she could be a role model to girls today who have many more things available to them to push them to be. Sarah Boone could be a role model that Elizabeth Holmes could not be.
Yeah, it seems like at that time, too, and for a long expanse of time, women who were innovators, women who were inventors, often did innovate and invent domestic products because they just weren't allowed anywhere near, you know, any kind of academic canon, or, you know, they weren't allowed inside those walls, but they solved problems with their imagination.
Well, Sarah Boone was solving a problem that was important to her, because she was a dressmaker in New Haven. There were many, many dressmakers. She wanted to make sure that her wares looked good compared to others. And the way that you ironed back in those days is that you had a plank on top of two chairs. And at that time, clothes were very fitted because the corset industry was huge. And so how do you iron around a tight waist or a tight sleeve? So that's the problem she was solving. She created a new ironing board that could that was narrow, sort of like what we have today, so that it could iron in those tight areas.
Another example of that would be in the area of the invention, the development of Pyrex. There's a woman with a very unsung story there too, right?
Well, yeah, Pyrex actually came from a housekeeper who came up with an idea. Bessie Littleton, her husband was a glass scientist at Pyrex, and he loved glass. He wanted to be buried in a glass container. And she said, you know, you always brag about how wonderful glass is and how thorough and durable it is, but my casserole dish just broke. Why don't you find something to replace that? And so he went to work. He had some materials that he was working on that were really durable glass, brought one of them home, and that's how Pyrex started. So it was actually Bessie Littleton who came up with the idea. The science was done by a glass scientist, but it was her idea for this huge huge product.
I assume, though, it takes a tremendous amount of digging into that story to find Bessie Littleton anywhere in it.
Well, even finding her pictures. In the book that's coming out next year, The Alchemy of Us, I had to dig for her pictures and dig for materials about her. The technical documents written by her husband are all available. But her story, you had to uncover.
Right. And I mean, I think versions of that happen a lot, and they happen in academia too, where you might have a woman who's working on something pretty exciting, something that's later on I can give my own. All of my examples are drenched in astronomy because that's what I was focusing on for 2 weeks. But of a woman who might write a real path-breaking paper, but somehow or other, like the way the paper is credited or something, there's like a thesis advisor sitting. There's like a bunch of men whose names often will appear before you get maybe to the person who did the work.
Yeah, it depends on your field. If you're the first name or if you're the last name has some significance. Mm-hmm. In physics, the last name, in other fields, it may be the first name.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're the last name, people will often think, well, your advisor must have been very generous and gave you that position instead of it being the credit of your work. I've had that happen in my own work where my name was the last name, mm-hmm. and while it was published, another name was added, and so that person became the last name.
Ooh.
Yeah.
So I think another problem is kind of us, you know. Ed Yong has been he's been on the show before, has written a lot about this, that he as a journalist has gone back and looked at his work and looked at work where he's reporting on in areas of science where women have made important contributions, but somehow or other, and he holds himself responsible for this, he didn't wind up quoting them, you know, somehow or other. I mean, there may be just unconscious blind spots that some of us have, or we feel more comfortable talking to a guy, or we're programmed in a way that we were not even aware of or something. But there's something about the way the media reports on this stuff too, right?
There's certainly a bias that we're also fighting. Mm-hmm. Also, a lot of women get asked to give a quote, and because they're, you know, inundated, they have to make a choice, so they may not get quoted as well. So since there's so few women and we want to quote from them, they get taxed more than just a regular guy down the hallway. So it's a little bit of two problems. It's the bias that journalists may have, but also that women are also taxed because there are very few of them.
Yeah. So one of the things you looked at was patents. How are women doing in the competition for patents?
We're still very low. We're not ahead.
No, you haven't caught up. Okay.
We haven't caught up, no. And we did start off in domestic things because that was a domain that women had lots of control, and they were solving problems that were important to them. But America has always grown in the number of patents. It's just that the number of women getting patents is not as high.
You worked at Bell Labs. That was a slightly different. I mean, it's possible to create a culture, right, where there's more excitement about everybody's contributions.
Yeah, well, I worked at Bell Laboratories, and I have a couple of patents when I was there. I worked for a boss who could write 3 patents in a weekend. So that was the culture. And also, there were some incentives. If you wrote a patent and it actually got patented, you would get a little bit of money. So that was really part of the culture. And it was a world of ideas. And it didn't really matter what body, what container that the idea came in. Sometimes you would see women getting excluded from a patent. But people were also very vocal about mentioning, because there were ways to like discuss patents. So women who felt like they weren't included in the right patent would get on the right patents. But it was a culture of ideas. So it was a little different than struggling and doing it on your own independently. The corporation encouraged people to patent their work.
You talk to kids these days. I don't know. I mean, has any of this notion of equity in STEM penetrated the youngest generation in the schools these days? Are girls more likely to think, oh, yeah, I could do that?
If you look at classrooms before middle school, girls are asking questions just as many questions as boys.
Mm-hmm.
But something happens around middle school where it starts to, you know, separate. And so we're working really hard to get girls excited about science. And we also have to think about it a little differently. When we were explaining or when we were selling the notion of STEM, we were using topics that were interesting to boys. That's not going to work for girls. Ends up that girls really love working on STEM problems if it's going to impact someone's life. Mm-hmm. So you have to propose it differently. But again, after middle school, something happens. And so we have to re-engage girls by giving them real world problems to solve.
You know, I don't know whether to give Disney credit. I'm always very suspicious of Disney and its agendas. But, for example, in the new reboot of Dumbo, there's a protagonist, a young girl named Millie, and all she really cares about is science. It's introduced in a very clunky kind of way, and it feels very kind of overdetermined. But there's a scene where she's at a big sort of theme park, I mean, back in the, you know, 30s, and she gets just stalled out at this Marie Curie exhibit. And I think Disney's done this a couple of times now recently with reboots where they've made the young women interested in science. Critics have complained that they use that as kind of a substitute for a fully developed feminist art. No, well, she's interested in science. That's good enough. All right. Don't complain to us.
Right.
But you do kind of need that, right? You need that kind of model, too, I think.
Well, they can check off that box. So,
it could be that.
But I think we can think about science a little differently. We don't need to have some nerdy kid and now it's a female, and so now we can check off that box.
Mm-hmm.
Science really needs to be more relevant, incorporated in all parts of life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the story that it requires a whole reboot in terms of how we think about STEM. Right now, we're just like, okay, they like to do STEM, and we kind of silo that topic. But STEM, science, touches all parts of our lives. This conversation is happening because of STEM. You know, we need to think about it as another layer of our daily lives. And I think if we do that, then more people will be interested in the topic than to just say, okay, well, you can be nerdy in this way and we're going to change this flavor so that it's more feminine now.
I mean, this is very specifically a conversation about that. Although one thing that you found, once again, in this sort of great man theory of things, sometimes men get pushed to the footnotes because it has to be one, has to be Alexander Graham Bell. It can't be him and a bunch of other people, right?
Right. So I'm working on this book, The Alchemy of Us, and it's about inventors. And, you know, when we think about inventors, we think Tesla, we think Edison.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they had helpers.
Yeah.
And in particular, when you think of the light bulb, you think about Edison, even though Edison was a latecomer to this idea. Edison actually got inspired about the idea of going into the electric lights from a visit to Ansonia. He met a gentleman named William Wallace. He was his family owned Wallace Factory, which made brass products. And he was a gentleman scientist. And he made this early form of light, which was an arc light. It kind of looked like a huge static electricity charge. And Edison came to see him and had heard about this light. And people were like, you really got to get into electric lights. There's this guy in Connecticut who's working on it. So Edison came in September and looked at it and was really impressed. And then as he left William Wallace's home, he says, Wallace, I think I can beat you. I think you're doing it the wrong way.
Hmm.
And then he went back to Menlo Park and started working on the electric light. What he was saying to Wallace is that the way that he was creating light wasn't going to be sustainable. It required two pieces of carbon where an electric beam, electric bolt went between them and the carbon went away. And there's no way that you can build a light that way. What you needed something to glow, to condense, incandesce. And that's what the light bulb that Edison wanted to produce. But again, we don't hear about William Wallace. William Wallace gets a footnote, and often he even doesn't get mentioned. And no one from Connecticut, particularly in Ansonia, knows that they have contributed to the development of the light bulb. So, because we want to have one hero, and that's Edison.
Right. As long as we're doing Connecticut chauvinism, I discovered today that Barbara McClintock, who in 1983 got a Nobel Prize for science, which is unusual. I think after Marie Curie, there's 15 women total who have been given Nobel Prizes in the sciences. And that's not very much. And there's, it's easy to name three, you know, quite a few women who should have gotten Nobel Prizes. But anyway, Barbara McClintock, born in Hartford. I bet you there's no marker or anything like that.
I bet there isn't.
No.
Right.
Yeah. The truth is, she like moved away when she was six. So
that's okay.
That's still, we'll take it. We'll take it. She's a native.
In New Haven, we have banners for people who just like walk through. We're they're from us. They're from here.
Did his sophomore year here. Okay, fine. all right. So let's take a little break. We're going to talk more about another problem, which is kind of the way women are treated while they're trying to do their jobs in the sciences. And so we'll get to that after this.
Deep as any ocean.
Yeah, baby.
As sweet as any harmony.
Ooh,
she blinded me with science.
She blinded me with science.
Blinded me with science.
Paul, what's happening here?
Mr. Harrison, I would like to attend today's briefing.
Why is that?
Well, sir, the data changes so fast. The capsule changes, the weight and the landing zones are all changing every day. I do my work, you attend these briefings, I have to start over. Colonel Glenn launches in a few weeks. We don't have the man figured out yet.
Why is it she can't attend?
Because she doesn't have clearance, Al.
I cannot do my work effectively if I do not have all of the data and all of the information as soon as it's available. I need to be in that room hearing what you hear.
Pentagon briefings are not for civilians. It requires the highest clearance.
I feel like I'm the best person to present my calculations.
You're not going to let this go, are you?
No, I am not.
And she is a woman. There is no protocol for a woman
attending
these meetings.
Okay, I get that part, Paul. But within these walls, who makes the rules?
You, sir. You are the boss. You just have to act like one, sir.
All right. That, of course, is from Hidden Figures. I say with some pride that before Hidden Figures came out, we had, I think it was Nathalia Holt, who'd written the other book about Rocket Girls. We did a whole show about that. And at the end of the show, we had also discovered this program where women test pilots had been recruited and went through all of the training that the Mercury astronauts went through. The pretext being that they had to get ready to go into space. We actually found one of those women still living. But anyway, they never went into space. There was no plan to send them into space. Mm-hmm. They just wanted to know what it would be like if you put women through the rigors of a Mercury training. So there you go. Anyway, here in the studio with me is Anissa Ramirez, a scientist, science communicator, and a mechanical engineering professor at Yale for 10 years, currently writing a book called The Alchemy of Us. The more she talks about it, the more excited I get. Joining us now is Kate Clancy, associate professor of anthropology at the University of Illinois. She hosts the Period podcast, and yes, it is about that. She has also been very involved in studies of sexual harassment occurring in the sciences. So, Kate Clancy, welcome to our conversation.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, you most recently, at least the most recently that I'm aware of, you really looked at specifically astronomy, cosmology, what was going on there in the form of gender harassment. What was found in that study?
We had a couple of main findings. The most important was actually that the worst experiences, the most frequent experiences, were towards women of color. So women of color experienced the most sexual and racial harassment, then followed by white women, men of color, and white men. And in fact, to me, the most staggering result was that when we asked our participants, just in a 5-year window, have you ever been made to feel unsafe at work? And have you ever skipped professional events because you were made to feel unsafe? 40% of the women of color in our sample said that they felt unsafe, and 27% of the white women.
Anissa, you might want to chime in about this, just about how, I mean, women as a gender have their own stairs to climb here, but women of color, LGBT women, I assume, face even more.
I mean, when I read this report, I was reminded of when I would go to conferences I wouldn't go to all the talks. I would always take a break and go to the hotel room. And I couldn't remember why. And I think it was just to recharge my battery because you're just so inundated with messages that you don't belong, that you're a strange foreign body. And so I would just go to my room just to kind of like recalibrate, you know, sort of like breathing in when you're swimming. You take a breath, go back underwater, and then come back. So, we all can relay some stories about how we've been harassed and how we've how racism has impacted us. But I was just thinking about, my own upbringing as a scientist, how I had this strange habit of just hanging out in my hotel room for a while, even though there was a huge conference going on. And perhaps that was just my mechanism for dealing with it.
Well, Kate, I read so many things for this show. I don't remember where I read this, but I did read somewhere. That's not an uncommon thing that women scientists report turning down chances to go to professional conferences, turning down chances to lecture, just because they don't want to be in this that kind of environment, right?
Yeah. And, I think Dr. Ramirez earlier in the show also pointed out another reason why they might turn it down is that they're being inundated by requests because of the fact that they're so often tokenized and so rare within their discipline, and that itself is exhausting. So they're dealing with microaggressions. They're dealing with gender harassment, which are sexist forms of harassment or, put downs. And then they're just dealing with the fact that because they're made to feel that maybe the reason they're being invited or asked to speak or whatever is because they're being tokenized, that's yet another burden that they have to bear, because then, of course, they're dealing with these internalized feelings, this imposter syndrome of like, maybe I don't belong. Maybe I'm only being asked because I'm a woman of color or a white woman or whatever. And in fact, this is one of the things that we made sure in the National Academy's report that came out last year on sexual harassment of women in the sciences to address.
When this report came out, my sense was that an awful lot of women in science said, well, finally. I mean, we all knew this was happening. Finally, you got some numbers to back it up. But, Kate, you say, and you've written also, that the largest percentage of all this stuff is, as you say, put downs. And I'm just sort of trying to wrap my mind around that. And, I mean, I don't know. Could you give some examples? Like, what kinds of things? I'm sure Anissa has some, too. But some examples of put downs that get directed at women scientists?
Sure. I mean, there are so many. There are moments of exclusion, moments in which women are alienated from a broader experience. There are things that actually happen even when I go to give talks. I've had experiences where men will confront me afterwards and say, well, it should be okay for me to share topless videos of women at work. And I'm like, no, it's actually not okay. So objectifying women in the workplace, which then further alienates the women in the workplace, is not okay. Sexist comments about aptitude. I have a colleague who told me that one of the normal things in her faculty meeting is the men all sit at the main conference table, the women trickle in afterwards, and as they're trickling in, the men think it's really funny to say, women don't belong in science. And they think they're being funny, right? But the impact on these women is that they're made to feel excluded. One other big one that I'll briefly say is that there's a lot of testing behavior of like, are you going to be cool? Are you one of the guys? Or are you going to be one of those uptight girls that we can't hang with? And so sometimes showing images of pornography or just sort of doing these little moments of like, are you going to joke along with us or are you going to be uptight? Those kinds of testing behaviors are things that happen to lots of women and lots of gender minorities in the sciences.
I'm assuming you have your own examples of this.
Well, when I was at Bell Laboratories, there was a huge breakthrough in a new material, and my boss was one of these people that as soon as things broke, he would jump on it. And so there was a meeting, and we all kind of parsed out what we were going to do. And I missed that meeting. And sometime later, I found out that it actually happened at a strip club, and I wasn't invited. And so a whole bunch of people ended up being on this paper because the strategy was put together. The fact that I was excluded, and I found out later, and what do I do? Do I tell my boss's boss that I wasn't included? Because then it makes me look like a bad person and also indicates, things about my boss. So, strange things happen like that. And also you don't have any recourse because it's so unacceptable and it's exhausting. You come home and you're like, let me tell you the story today, as opposed to just doing your life of science.
I should probably just take this moment to say that the reason we're doing this show is because my senior producer is Betsy Kaplan. Betsy Kaplan, first of all, had a medical background before she came here, but she makes sure we do these shows. She makes sure we do shows also that have good representation. I'm going to talk a little bit later about Sarbani Basu, who's a helioseismologist. But the first time we did a show with her, it was a show about the sun. There were two women guests, two men guests. We don't feel good. We don't get it every time. We don't hit it every time, but we do try. And a lot of the credit has to go to Betsy Kaplan. So it seems to me a lot of this also, and one of the things that has to happen is we have to tell the stories differently, right? That as you assign reading starting in elementary school and going all the way up through college, you want to tell the story of women's accomplishments, but also what they're up against, Kate. It's part of the story is not, I mean, for example, one of the people that I'm obsessed with right now is Vera Rubin. Vera Rubin should have a Nobel Prize. I mean, she basically discovered dark matter. But when she first wanted to work at the Palomar Observatory, I think this was back in the 1960s, there literally was not a women's bathroom. And she had to build one. And she made somehow or other, I don't know how she did it, she made a women's bathroom so she could get her work done at Palomar. And Kate, it seems to me that as we, you know, as we tell stories, as we assign reading and stuff like that, it's important to get that part of the story across.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that really bothers me when we talk about the dearth of women in science and women of color in particular is that we use these really passive metaphors like, oh, it's a leaky pipeline or a chilly climate. But really, the metaphor that I and several of my colleagues have been really trying to put forward is that, no, it's a gauntlet. If you remember what a gauntlet is, it's two rows of people hitting you over the head with sticks or swords. That's what it's like to be a woman in science. It's that when women leave, or when they choose not to go in at all, it's because they're being pushed out or encouraged not to come. It's not that they're just sort of sliding out passively, but explicit things are happening to them that are making them feel unwelcome and causing real harm.
I mean, we were talking, Anissa, about Maria Curie a couple seconds ago and in the context of the new Dumbo movie. But, you know, that's usually a story told about sort of, yes, you can do that. You can do that just fine. And the story isn't told about the kind of obstacles Marie Curie had to get around.
Right. Well, Marie Curie, which is always the, you know, the icon of what we, when we throw out stories about women in STEM, you know, she got a Nobel Prize. She found a new, two new elements, a new form of science. When she came back home to France, she couldn't be a member of the French Academy of Sciences because she was a woman. Nobody in the French Academy of Sciences had a Nobel Prize. She did. So it's just, you know, it's incredible that a woman with, you know, with such gravitas had to deal with the same kind of issues that we're all we're talking about today.
First of all, I just want to plug a book and just say also that we invited this person as a guest. And in fact, we've invited her several times now about this book. And she, I guess she just won't do it. But so Maria Popova has a pretty amazing book out right now called Figuring that gets very much into this question of sort of how women realize their potential across history, starting, I think, with Maria Mitchell, who actually discovered a comet up on a roof in Nantucket. She wasn't on the faculty of anything at that point, but really sort of, you know, became a very prominent woman astronomer. But there's, anyway, it's a great book. It has a lot of these kinds of stories. Kate, there's another side to this, and that is what gets researched, what attracts research money. And I'm guessing that if it's to deal with a disease that only affects women, the same problems are kind of showing up on the subject of research end of this spectrum?
Absolutely. I mean, there are ways in which women's lived experiences, women and gender minorities, I should say, are just continually gaslit and denied. Our pain is not acknowledged as significant as men. Our lived experience, the ways, you know, the experiences that we have in medicine and the experiences that we have at school and in the workplace, they're just continually seen as less important, less worthy of study. And so what's been really important is, of course, as some of these disciplines have started to be, have started to see better representation of some of these underserved and underrepresented folks, of course, we're seeing these really interesting, really new questions being asked. And to me, that's one of the most important elements of trying to address workplace and school issues around harassment, is that I'm really curious about all the really wonderful science that we've lost when we've forced so many of us to have to use so much of our brain just to handle the daily harassment, daily microaggressions and incivilities of our workplaces.
I want to come back to that in just a second, but another part of that, what gets research money, Anissa, has to do, I think, also with people of color. Diseases that people of color disproportionately get, I assume, are less likely to attract the money and the time.
Yeah, well, you know, sickle cell anemia, lupus, these are all things that are fall under African American and don't have the same level of funding as I don't know, you know, balding medicines and things like that. I mean, you know, it's just a matter of who's in the room to select who what should be funded. And also, I know people who are working on sickle cell, people, they're not considered to be serious researchers because they're working on something so narrow. However, you know, some of the topics that get funded are equally as narrow. So narrow is just code for, you know, that's not important.
So yeah, I also want to talk about the effect of telling these stories. So it's important to tell these stories and get these stories out into the daylight. But I also wonder, like, Kate, maybe you can even, I don't remember all the details of this, but at one point, I think it was in your work, I encountered this completely horrific story that took place in Antarctica where this male scientist was, like, really, you know, physically abusing a female colleague. You do want to quickly flesh that out a little bit?
Sure. That's the, I've been encouraged to make sure to say alleged story of David Marchant, who is at Boston University geologist. And this is someone that I talk about in my congressional testimony as well. He's someone who he blew volcanic ash, which contains glass, if you don't know, into the eyes of a woman. A female graduate student of his. He tried to force her to have sex with his brother. He pushed her down a mountain 3 separate times, mocking her the entire way, and threw rocks at her while she was trying to urinate. And these are the kinds of things. Sometimes when I tell stories in a coded way, mm-hmm. When I give talks on these on sexual harassment, which I do quite a bit, I will have people come up to me afterwards and say, "Oh, that story, I know where that is. That's from this field site." And they're pretty much always wrong. Not mm-hmm. that I would tell them anyway, because obviously I'm protecting confidentiality. But the commonality of even these things like disrupting or mocking a woman while she's trying to urinate or trying to change her menstrual pad or like deal with these sort of daily hygiene issues over the course of the day. These things are disturbingly common in the field sciences.
But you want to get these stories out and drag them out into the light of day. But you also wonder, I mean, will that have a chilling effect? Will young women hear these stories and go, you know what, maybe I should do something else with my life. That sounds really horrible.
I really don't think that they do. I mean, research suggests that when you tell women the reality of their experience and what it does is it allows them to externalize what's happening and say, oh, it's not when I encounter obstacles in the sciences, it's not that I stink at being a scientist or that I don't belong. It's that these people have a problem with my being here. And when you can externalize it and say, wow, it's not about me. It's about structural oppression or it's about this one jerk in my workplace or whatever. It actually makes it easier to handle things and potentially also easier to seek social support. And be able to say to somebody else, hey, I had this thing happen. Isn't this kind of messed up? And then you can commiserate and form a little bit of armor against the next time that might happen.
Well, we just have a few minutes to entirely fix this culture. So let's try to do that. And Nisa, I don't know, how do we fix it? I mean, this, you know, as Kate is saying, these things are so prevalent that if you tell a horrible story about the, you know, ridicule of a woman urinating or changing her menstrual pad, 18 people will think it happened at 18 different field sites because it's just such a common thing. I don't know. How do you change the culture of science so it's not like that?
I think we need to bolster the numbers. Kate just talked about commiserating. And I remember when I took a sabbatical at MIT, there were more faculty of color there than there were at Yale. So for me, it was like paradise. And there was a dinner and there were over 30 people. And at one point, we all talked about horrible things that happened to us. And it was so cathartic. I won, of course, which means I actually lost. But it was wonderful to be around other people where you had this silent understanding of knowing that these things happened and that, you know, you weren't carrying it because you saw that other people were experiencing it as well. So I think that, you know, if we increase the numbers and if we can put together places where people can talk about these things, that would certainly help. Kate probably has more systematic things that can help. But I know that when I was in a space where there were more numbers and I can talk about these things, that the burden felt a little lighter.
I'm going to go to Kate in just a second, but while I've got you, I'm also wondering about your go back to the Bell Labs story. It seems to me that in environments where if one person wins, everybody wins, you know, everybody feels good about, you know, people's victories. I'm assuming a lot of men, if they're behaving as swine and abusive jerks, they're threatened. They're threatened by the influx of women who they'll feel that they have to compete with and be insecure about it. I mean, is there also just a way to design a scientific culture so that everybody sort of feels like everybody wins? Like if the department has a, you know, wins a big award or something, it's not so much of, I guess it's more of a socialist than a capitalist system of assigning credit.
I think it helps, but on a granular level, if someone is a jerk, someone's a jerk. Mm-hmm. And so you need to have some checks and balances to be able to report that out. But yeah, you can have departments where they all get you know, a pizza party based on something. That's great. But you still need to be able to say, hey, this is not appropriate, and have a dialogue about it. And also, you don't necessarily have to be in the picture when you report that out. There should be some infrastructure that discusses with them in a real way where it's promoting change.
And not a pizza party at a strip club.
No.
Because pizza's never any good there anyway.
Well, I would know. No, I wasn't invited.
I'm speculating. So Kate, what about that? If we could change the culture, what change would you make?
Well, first, I'd second the 2 points that Dr. Ramirez made, which is first to increase representation of women of color specifically and women and gender minorities more generally. And I would also say having real consequences for perpetrators and folks who do harm. There are lots of places where you can report and then nothing really happens. The things I would add is making sure that everything we do is victim centered. Pretty much every single victim I speak to, the first thing they say is, I just want the behavior to stop so I can get back to my science. Right. I mean, we get into the sciences because it's a calling, because we want to make the world better, because we have some big, noble goal of this amazing thing we want to transform about the world. And when that's taken away from us because the people around us in some fundamental way don't feel like we belong, it diminishes us, but it also diminishes our science. The one final thing I'll say is that the incentive structures and reward structures of science are really fundamentally broken when we reward selfishness and cruelty, and when we equate scientific rigor with being a jerk to somebody in a colloquium. So when we start to think about the ways in which, hey, maybe our culture, maybe we're at fault in a more general way, and that some of these more frequent but low-level slights are actually creating conditions that allow these more severe things to happen. So maybe we need to nip things in the bud and deal with some of the cruelty and incivility that seem to just be part of the scientific norm.
All right. That was Kate Clancy. Thank you so much for Kate Clancy, Associate Professor of Anthropology at the University of Illinois. Thanks to the Illinois Public Media. That's whose studios, I guess, we've been using. She also hosts the Period podcast, which you should absolutely check out. So Anissa Ramirez and I are going to stay here, and we're going to take a little break. When we come back, we are going to talk about the world of Wikipedia, which is supposed to be a place where, you know, average users can make sure that certain things that are being overlooked in the canon get redressed. We'll see how that works with the topic we're talking about right now. It's the people that say men are leading the women astray, but I'll say it's the women today, the smarter than the man in every way. Well, that's right. The women are smart.
Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, Kyone Wolf. Wait, I'm being told that Jonathan McPants and Josh Nalea are receiving full producing credit. That is an outrage. McPants isn't even here. He's home changing diapers. Should we start calling him McDiaper? Amanda Fish did everything Flipper did, but backwards and in high heels. Our intern is Kayla Thomas. The part of Bill Curry was played by Taraji P. Henson. On tomorrow's show, I fall through the looking glass of a vending machine. And now... back to Colin.
That is true. We're keeping tomorrow's show kind of a mystery, but that is part of it. All right. So we're talking about the way that women are or are not given credit, patents, recognition, access to funding, resources in the whole world of STEM. And our guide through this topic has been Anissa Ramirez, a scientist and scientist communicator, professor of mechanical engineering at Yale for 10 years, currently writing a book called The Alchemy of Us. Now, one of my favorite topics in the world is Wikipedia. And I, in fact, even have tried to convince at least one place to let me teach an entire course in Wikipedia, but that has fallen on an unfriendly ear so far. But we have a really interesting project we're going to talk about right now. Emily Temple Wood, a medical student at Midwestern University Chicago College of Osteopathic Medicine, is the founder of Wikipedia Project Women Scientists. And Jess Wade, postdoctoral researcher in physics at Imperial College London's Blackett Laboratory. So they're both part of this. And so I don't know who's where. I guess Jess is there, and then I'm pointing in a way that's not helpful to the listeners. And so Emily's on Skype. Is that how that's working? Yeah.
Hello.
Hi. So Emily, maybe get us started here. Tell us how this project evolved, or how you got the idea to do this.
Sure. So Wiki Project Women Scientists began when I was in my undergrad education. So I had participated in something called Ada Lovelace Day, which is a celebration of women in science history. And upon finding that there were so many missing women scientist biographies, I did what any Wikipedian would do, which is start a wiki project, which is just a group of people who are interested in the same thing who can participate together. and it took off.
Well, yeah, and because earlier Anissa and I were talking about Barbara McClintock, we should probably mention Barbara. Yes. That was one of the first pages you did?
It was one of the ones I worked the longest on. Mm-hmm. And Barbara McClintock is just such a wonderful scientist who did so much for both cytogenetics and women's recognition in science. So
did you have to make a page for her?
I did not. Okay. Fortunately, no. Yeah. She had won the Nobel Prize, so she's included.
That's what I was going to say. With the Nobel Prize, there probably should be a Wikipedia page sitting there. Whether it's good enough or not is a whole other question. But yeah, I mean, you know, we wouldn't have CRISPR probably at this point without the work that she did. So
that's very true.
So let's bring Jess into the conversation too. So there's an odd coincidence, Jess Wade, which is that last week I was doing a panel on astronomy. Sarbani Basu was on my panel. She's the chair of astronomy at Yale. So today, just on a hunch, I pulled up her Wikipedia page and checked the history. And who did I find? Who did I find there, Jess Wade?
So I think the amazing thing about what Emily did was that she really, really started this movement of people who care a lot, not only about preserving women's stories and their biographies, but also about getting the science right. So it's this idea that you don't only make a kind of super basic Wikipedia page, or you don't only make one that says, you know, this is this woman, she's a professor, she's married to this male professor, but you actually make one that describes their science comprehensively as well. And I think that just means that they, you know, they have so much more of a rich biography that people go to and want to learn from. And so that's something that I found so inspirational about what Emily's done. It's not just the quantity of the pages, it's actually the quality too. So a couple of years ago, I was just kind of sitting in London reading an incredible book called Inferior, How Science Got Women Wrong. And I met in this book all of these kind of incredible activists throughout history who have been standing up and saying, you know, you have absolutely no reason to say that women are intellectually inferior to men, which is what Charles Darwin said. Because at the moment, society is incredibly biased against women, and particularly women of color succeeding. And in that book, you come across so many phenomenal women, just like Emily, throughout history, have been campaigning to change that. And then I also met another Wikimedian. It wasn't Emily herself, but I met someone who taught me about this impact that an American Wikipedian had, something called the Kilana effect. So Emily's username on Wikipedia is Kilana. And this idea that since Emily had started editing, there'd been a dramatic increase in the number of women scientists' pages, but also in the quality of the pages. And then that just inspired me so much, I started really seriously editing at the beginning of 2018.
Right. So anyway, Jess Wade did, I believe, originate the page for Sarbani Basu, who you will hear, I believe, next Wednesday, when we're doing the astronomy show, because we took the panel that we did last week. We're turning it into a radio show. So you'll actually hear about her and her work. And there's some pretty fascinating stuff there. So, Emily, well, first of all, Anissa, as you're trying to pull your book together, you were saying earlier, just getting pictures sometimes, finding basic kinds of stuff that you need about some of these women inventors was difficult.
Oh, well, I on my work with Sarah Boone, fortunately, there was an article a couple of years ago, so people wanted to write about Sarah Boone, so she definitely had a Wikipedia page. But the thing that I personally struggle with is that the image that's always associated with her is incorrect. Hmm. The image that's there is usually this African-American sculptor. Her name was Mary Edmonia Lewis. That's always associated with Sarah Boone. That's not Sarah Boone. And I often have to go to Wikipedia pages or different web pages and say, sorry, that is not Sarah Boone. So that's one of the troubles, especially if you're looking at people far back in history, like the 1800s, where you have to, get scraps of paper to build the story, but you also have to make sure that the images are correct as well.
And so, Emily, another part of all this was dealing with trolls. I'm once again kind of amazed that trolls can figure out that this is happening and then decide that they care about it, and then they decide that they're going to try to make your life miserable. How did they do that?
I've been a Wikimedian since I was 12 years old, so I'm no stranger to people on the internet being angry at me for something that I've done. Whether it's removing their, you know, childish vandalism from a Wikipedia page or trying to write about women scientists who they think, for some reason, that reason being sexism, that they don't matter. And they would send me awful, just vulgar, horrendous emails, threaten to contact my boss or my professors, try to contact my parents, my school, like things like that, and generally try to make me feel unsafe, which didn't work particularly well.
No, I get the feeling it did not. So
no.
So is there a way to put a number on how many pages exist now because of this effort?
A couple hundred at least. I've definitely slowed down in general lately just because of medical school. But fortunately, there's wonderful people like Jess who are carrying the torch.
And well, there's also, I guess, as a kind of peculiar form of there's some Skinnerian term for this, but the way that you've dealt with the trolls partly is you use each one of them as an occasion to do another page.
Mm-hmm. It came about because I was so frustrated one day. I'd gotten some particularly upsetting emails. And I was talking to some of my friends and said that I needed to do something more productive than just be angry, because I was sitting there being angry and ruminating and being unproductive. And I said, well, I'm going to channel my anger into doing the thing that they hate the most, which is, you know, fighting systemic bias and doing feminist history. So I did, and it felt really good. And then I kept going, mm-hmm. and here we are.
Right. So, Jess Wade, I just also want to just get you to elaborate on something else that you said, which was, I mean, it seems as though when you write these bios, when you write these Wikipedia articles, you really do need, in the case of these women scientists, often to explain something that you wouldn't have to explain otherwise. And I mean, if it's Jocelyn Bell Burnell, who essentially discovered pulsars but did not share the Nobel Prize for discovering pulsars, you got to explain why that is. If it's Rosalind Franklin, who, you know, did a lot of really important work that Watson and Crick are known for, you got to tell that story, right? You got to, like, why don't we know that name? Because of the following reasons.
Sure you do, but actually their Wikipedia page isn't a reason to discuss the biases that there were against them at the time. The Wikipedia page is the page to describe who they were, where they got to in their research, and what really they contributed to the scientific field. So I actually, as someone who works in physics, so I work on kind of new materials for electronic devices, I can pretty much handle biographies about physicists or chemists quite easily. But when I have to stray into things like psychology and geography, I find it so stressful and difficult. I have to find some other experts to try and help me. So the kind of tricky part is conveying quite technical research to a general public, which is what Wikipedia is, right? As you said before, everyone goes on it and everyone should learn how to edit it so that we make it, you know, better for generations to come. But I do think what's been said in this discussion about the idea that we actually need really good resources, we need really, really good images of these women and people of color, and we really need good references that we can cite. And something that I've come up against a lot, especially with trying to make the pages of women of color, scientists and engineers, is the lack of references, you know, the lack of media talking about them or writing about them, and the lack of places that even just broadcast and celebrate their research. And that's really, really tricky. You know, you can't obviously cite LinkedIn, you can't cite social media, you can't cite really a university website. So what we need is academic journals and kind of big newspapers and radio like you to be talking about these people so that we can use them to create their biographies online.
All right. We sort of run out of time here, and it's too bad because there's a whole other area that I wanted to get into with these two guests, but maybe we'll have to just roll that over to another show. I really want to second Jess's emotion. This is something that I say to classes that I teach, is if you're going to use Wikipedia, become a Wikipedia contributor, just get your little logon and password and stuff like that, because you should know how articles are edited. You should know how articles are created. You should have some idea of how this whole process works if you're going to use it. And also, just, you know, if you're going to benefit from other people's expertise, and you have any expertise, and most people do, you should make contributions that way too. Anyway, well, listen, thanks to all of our guests today. Thanks to senior producer Betsy Kaplan for coming up with this show and making it happen. And special thanks to Anissa Ramirez for spending the day, or at least an hour of the day, in the studio with me and helping me understand all this stuff. And we'll be back tomorrow with vending machines, but boy, not like any other vending machine show you ever heard. Not that you ever actually heard a show about vending machines before. Anyway.